You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. About 7 years into the U.S. occupation of Iraq, as public opinion was turning hard against the war, leaks from inside the U.S. military started making headlines. The first was a video of a 2007 Black Hawk helicopter strike that killed a group of civilians, including two journalists who were working for Reuters. Then there was a dump of war logs from Afghanistan, then Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, diplomatic cables from the State Department. None of it cast the U.S. government or its war efforts in a particularly good light. And the person responsible for all those leaks, in short order, was caught, court-martialed, sent to prison for nearly 7 years, and ultimately released because of a commutation from President Obama.
Let's be clear. Chelsea Manning has served a tough prison sentence.
The point where she is released from prison is the point where our next guest started a documentary about her. Tim Travers Hawkins is the director of XY Chelsea, which is now up on Showtime. He joins us over Skype. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why did you want to do this film?
I was working actually on a series of activist art projects with political prisoners. And actually the sort of point behind it was we were working with people who were literally unfilmable. So they were in under conditions, either in hiding or in prison, where we couldn't get cameras to them. And we were looking at different ways that we could use, you know, new media, interactive media, even virtual reality, to make their stories available to people in a way that would inspire empathy. So while I was working on that, which was 2015, I heard that Chelsea had been thrown into solitary confinement in the military prison in Leavenworth, and actually wrote her a letter, just really human to human in solidarity. And we began, you know, I didn't really expect a reply, to be honest, but a few months later, I got one from her directly. And we began to converse over letters, and I told her about that project, and she was really excited by it, actually. And at the time, a lot of what we were doing was recording voices over the phone, and so I suggested that to her, but the military actually wouldn't even let us do that. So what she began to do was mail me these very intimate personal diaries that she was writing in prison. And from reading them, I kind of really realized that although the disclosures and the court-martial had already, you know, played out in 2010, that there was this incredible ongoing story, which was more the story of her fighting with the military to be recognized as a woman and for her own identity. And it was during the filming of those elements that the commutation came about in a very surprising way. I mean, there was hope, but not much of it. And I don't think anyone expected it to happen. And so I was there the very moment that the call came through to her lawyer from the White House.
Nancy just got the order.
I just got the order.
With Barack Obama's signature. So
oh
that
my
is
God.
In possession.
I feel like my world has been turned upside down.
At this point, Chelsea Manning's kind of remarkable in that she is extremely famous and extremely not in control of how her story is told. She's been in custody the entire time she's been famous.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, there's the moment of the commutation, which was just, you know, it was a shot of adrenaline, but so many other emotions as well, because I'd become very, you know, close to this team. And I got to know Chelsea, even if we'd never met at that stage, you know, in other ways. And then there's the end of the film, which ends with her going back into prison because she's taking a stand against the grand jury process and does not want to participate in it. So, you know, it's really incredible that she finds herself again in this situation. And it's, you know, so sad that also I think this makes it very much harder for her to explain her side of the story.
I mean, she's drawn fire on a lot of fronts from the U.S. government for the allegedly indiscriminate way that she dumped documents. The argument is she didn't adhere to some of the ethical standards journalistic organizations might have about redacting personally identifiable information and therefore put people at risk. She's also drawn some skepticism on the left for her associations with Julian Assange. She's become a bit of a pariah, and appearances she put in at a couple of alt-right rallies early in the Trump era.
Sure. Well, I mean, firstly, the manner of the disclosures was, you know, Chelsea wasn't the publisher here. She wanted people to know what was going on. And I think we have to remember that she was a source and not a publisher. You know, the publishers were initially the New York Times, The Guardian and Der Spiegel, and then later WikiLeaks, who made the decision to publish all of the documents without any redactions. That was actually a decision made by them and not by Chelsea. And I think we have to remember, you know, this has been a story that is traditionally told from the side of and from the angle of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks or from the US government. But Chelsea's side of the story up to now has been really the factor that's been left out of it. And I really wanted to tell this film from her POV, from her perspective. And one of the things that's obvious is that she never actually met Assange, and she never really even had a conversation with him in a moment where it was 100% clear that it was him. You know, there were some chats online, but they were short and they weren't definitive. So really the idea that they have some very close relationship is a fallacy, and I think is due to us sometimes viewing this entire story in a slightly retrospective way. WikiLeaks, when she disclosed the documents, was a very, very fringe and small publisher, but with an advanced understanding and knowledge of encryption tools, which made them unique within the news space. I don't think that necessarily they're not the only people in town now who know how to protect sources in a digital era. So perhaps now she would have gone to another outlet. But of course, I think it's unfortunate that the sort of personal aspects of Assange should then spill over onto other people around him who he's associated with.
You document through a kind of reconstructed chat logs the way she got caught, which was through correspondence with someone in the hacking community, Adrian Lamo. And you also kind of follow her throughout the film, you know, getting sucked into Twitter exchanges, exercising, I think, she did draw this fire for, like, you know, appearing at a rally that was put up by right-wing conspiracy theorist Mike Cernovich. She ultimately said, I'm doing research on the alt-right, but she was also mugging for selfies with participants in the rally. Like, do you...
Right. Well, you know, I think we have to remember a few things here. We're so quick to judge people. And Chelsea is someone who genuinely is trying to fight in very real ways against these elements. And of course, she made a mistake there. She admits it herself. But I think what was behind that was she wants to engage. I think she's somebody who just always wants to engage. And when she left prison, she quickly built up this big platform on Twitter. And I think she looked at that and said, right, well, how can I use this to either, signal boost causes that I believe in, or to, affect people's opinions of me, my actions, and those causes that I believe in very strongly. And, I think the appearance at the party was a stunt. It was intended to be a stunt that would draw attention to the fact that there is this growing community around these conspiracy theorists, and that is not a good thing. And I think one thing the film is very honest about is that, she's a human being and we all make mistakes. I think during her incarceration, one of the sort of inadvertent effects of her invisibility was that, people on the progressive left really projected onto her all these different ideas that they had because they didn't really know who she was. And there were expectations that she was never going to be able to live up to, really, particularly considering how much of her life had been derailed by that prison. She went into the army when she was so young. She was institutionalized by first the military, then prison. So it was just so tough for her to come out into this hyper-mediated environment after that. And I think actually something that's really interesting in the film is that, she goes from this position of invisibility in prison to very, very, very quickly this absolute opposite extreme of hyper-visibility.
In the portions of the film where she talks about, her initial decision to start exfiltrating documents that she had access to as a U.S. military analyst, it's clear that she still feels intensely complicit in U.S. war crimes in Iraq.
Well, I think, you know, we all are to some degree. And, you know, I think what's interesting with, for example, Collateral Murder, the video you described, it's not, of course, that we live in a world where there's just blackout censorship of these conflicts. We could see what was going on, really. We could understand to a large degree that things were not going right. You know, government propaganda wasn't really winning out. But I think Collateral Murder has a special quality to it. I'm not quite sure what that is, but there's something about it that's truly haunting. And I think that really, at that moment when it came out, it really did capture people's imaginations and really show this sort of complexity and horror of what was going on. The sad thing is I can't say for sure, really, if there was enduring impact of those disclosures, because it doesn't appear to me that things have changed radically since then.
Yeah, I mean, it showed you that Apache helicopter strike from the perspective of the people who were carrying it out, who sounded not the slightest bit apprehensive about the death and devastation they were wreaking on the people below them.
You know, just the image of the crawling man is truly chilling. And exactly, it's that disconnection the fact that the perpetrators seem to have no empathy whatsoever. And of course, that's part of military training. But it's also part of the way that technology has been used in weapons to create more and more distance between those who are pulling the trigger and those who are being, you know, shot. And of course, you know, shortly afterwards, really, drones became much, much more prevalent. And now we're quite used to that kind of footage, that kind of very detached footage coming from drones, which really echoes that Collateral Murder video as well.
So it becomes clear through a bunch of things she says in the documentary that she felt releasing things like that video was a matter of moral necessity, in part because she was complicit in the war effort. But you also play the tape from her sentencing hearing during her court-martial, where she kind of ambiguously apologizes for what she did.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that my actions hurt people. I'm sorry that it hurt the United States.
How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, I mean, for me, the clip in question, the really chilling thing about it is that she says,
I look back at my decisions and wonder,
you know, how did I,
a junior analyst,
a young analyst,
possibly believe I could change the world for the better?
And I think there's actually two very interesting reads on that. Of course, it's in part of an apology, but I think, you know, under the kind of duress she was experiencing then, it's no surprise whatsoever that she should apologize. I don't think it means that she thought she did the wrong thing necessarily. I think there's an element to not really understanding the full implications of what she did. That doesn't, you know, I think there's a gray area in between supporting herself and her actions and fully thinking that it was just entirely one big mistake. And I think context is everything there. But also, on this matter of how did I think I could possibly change the world, for me, that's just such a sad and melancholy moment, because I think we need ideological people. We need people who kind of dream impossible things, like, if I do this, then I can save lives. If I do this, I can stop another war happening. And maybe as we get older, we become more cynical. We become accustomed to the fact that, you know, every 5 years there's a huge protest movement that seems to go nowhere, that the power doesn't change. But isn't it sad that, you know, young people should come to that realization so early on, that actually them thinking that they could change the world is just such a sort of naive way to think.
Your film wraps with kind of the next chapter of her saga. She's going back to prison, this time for refusing to testify to a grand jury that turns out to be the grand jury that was considering charges against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
We'd actually finished making the film. We'd locked the film. We'd delivered the film. And then the grand jury happened. And she told us it was going to happen. She told us that she wasn't going to testify. And I don't think anyone quite thought that she would be treated in such a punitive way, especially the second time round. Nancy Hollander, who's Chelsea's appeals lawyer, she says right towards the end that, you know, they can wrap up this grand jury and then start another one. And each time there's a new grand jury, there's another 18-month, you know, maximum charge added to Chelsea for being in contempt. And that's exactly what happened. She came out for 6 days when they wrapped up one grand jury. And then the moment she left prison, they gave her another one. And 6 days later, she was before the court again and back in prison. And apparently the prison that when she went back to the detention center in Alexandria, they'd basically just kept her cell exactly as it was. They'd kept it ready for her. So this is a really chilling development and means she's trapped in this indefinite loop potentially for a long time unless she can successfully appeal. And of course, what they've done now on top of that is added this level of extortion, if you like, where she's being charged $500 a day that she's in prison. And after 60 days, that goes up to $1,000. So I think it really shows to me how absolutely petty the US government prosecutors can be. They don't need her testimony. It's just a way of getting after her and getting her back, I think.
Well, how can you know that they don't need her testimony?
Well, because they have it already from the court-martial. The only danger, of course, for her testifying in this, because she's been given impunity, is that she could perjure herself. So essentially, if she just says what she said in the court-martial originally, she's fine. And they already have that. They already have the transcript. In fact, it's the biggest record of any trial in U.S. military history. It's absolutely huge, and they can go through all the information there. And everything that's come out so far in terms of the indictment against Assange is just stuff taken directly from that court-martial. And Chelsea's stand against this is not that she's frightened that they're going to find new information from her. She's frightened that about this entire system, that's just wrong. A grand jury is so secretive. You don't have a lawyer there with you. There's all sorts of reasons why, you know, Americans shouldn't support the way that this particular grand jury is being carried out.
I guess, I mean, the kind of official origin story of the grand jury is it's meant to be there as a check on prosecutorial abuse, so that the lawyers who were empowered by the state to bring criminal charges have some kind of civilian oversight. And the conversation happens in private so as not to sully the reputation of people who've not actually been charged with anything.
Well, yes, but this was a very public situation, so I'm not quite sure if that really applies here.
Yeah. So that's the principle she's defending, is opposition to the grand jury system in general?
Absolutely, to certain elements of it, to the elements of secrecy. I think, you know, this grand jury was sealed for, I think a decade, and only very recently unsealed because Julian Assange was taken into custody by the UK government. And of course, Assange repeatedly said that it existed, and that was why he was, you know, choosing to remain in the embassy. And he was right.
Tim Travers Hawkins, thank you for the film, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us about it.
Thank you so much.
Tim Travers Hawkins is director of a new documentary that follows Chelsea Manning through the phase of her life that follows President Obama's commutation of her prison sentence. It is entitled XY Chelsea. It's currently airing on Showtime. Just a little bit before 8:28 in the morning, the program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Here's a few other events coming up that you may want to put on your calendar. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, June 25th, John Carlos Frey is giving a KPFA talk on his new book, Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexico Border. Incredibly timely. That'll be at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church at 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. And then one day later on Wednesday, June 26th, Marxist economist Richard Wolff and host of KPFA's program Economic Update will be coming to town to speak at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley at 2345 Channing Way. All of our KPFA events are wheelchair accessible.
Events always start at 7:30 p.m. unless you hear us say otherwise. And tickets are always available in advance online through brownpapertickets.com and over-the-counter at support of local independent booksellers. The San Francisco Mime Troupe is getting ready to launch this year's production. It is entitled Treasure Island. It is not about mythical pirates of yore, but buried radioactive waste of the present. It's going to be debuting Thursday, July 4th at 2 p.m. in Dolores Park, as is their wont. But it'll be crossing the bay to Berkeley the following weekend, July 6th and 7th. It'll be at Cedar Rose Park. Their productions generally start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There's full details on their calendar at www.sfmt.org. That stands for San Francisco Mime Troupe. Just past 8:29 in the morning. The program is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Teeger. I may have said that already. It's a Monday. Coming up in the second half of this hour, we're going to take a dive into the history behind current events. Right now, the Trump administration is trying to put together an anti-Iran coalition on the Persian Gulf. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Saudi Arabia this morning. We're going to talk about the history of the regional rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, why it got the way it is, how the U.S. landed on the side it did. We'll speak to Dr. Christian Coates-Ulrichsen, a fellow for the Middle East at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. All that and more coming up next after the news.